New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Grant McCracken, cultural anthropologist, Harvard professor, author, consultant, and so much more. We'll be hearing about his adventures exploring the American consumer landscape and what his findings tell us about the world of media and society at large. Grant, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I wanted to talk to you about Dark Value and your book, and also about the piece you recently wrote in Wired about how Netflix was transforming the cultural role of television. I'm especially interested in how culture and television and where entertainment is moving. And so I was wondering if you could give a little bit for people who maybe haven't read that article, a little bit of understanding around that, and also sort of the view from 60,000 feet, Dark Value.
What order do you want me to talk about?
Well, let's first just give the sort of 60,000 feet view of Dark Value so that people understand the concept. And then let's drill down and talk about how Dark Value relates to entertainment.
Okay, sounds good. Dark Value is the value that economists don't want to talk about. It's the value that doesn't show on any of their instruments. And because it's not visible to the economists, it's generally speaking not visible to the organization or the corporation. So it's often created by an organization like Uber or Airbnb, but in fact, it's not factored into the way in which they think about what they're doing or what they're selling or what they're bringing to market. And it doesn't get factored into our understanding of what's happening in our culture. And in a moment, we'll talk about what's happening to entertainment and what's happening to TV. The big headline there is that we've moved from being a culture that was, you know, slightly embarrassed by its popular culture. TV was called the wasteland. It was called the idiot box. And people who watch TV were called, you know, slugs and variously scorned for their TV enthusiasm. That's the old world. The new world is that TV has got better. As it got better, it became the natural center of American culture. For a long time, TV was kind of the idiot cousin of the American arts and letters. And now it is the place where difficult stories get told. And out of those difficult and interesting and engaging stories get told. And out of that telling comes all of the things that we care about when we talk about culture. The culture that's coming out of television is now, well, let's make it a circle. Because culture is better and smarter and more nuanced as a storytelling exercise, it pulls on more of the world around it. So it's more about the entire culture that surrounds it. And I think this trend began, I always like to say, with Buffy. I'm not sure if it's exactly true. It's hard to identify this. But do you remember when Buffy the Vampire Slayer used to let little remarks slip in the course of an episode? Which remarks were designed to let you know that her character was knowledgeable about the rest of TV culture and prepared to make a joke at its expense. And that, you know, that broke one of the big rules of TV, which was a kind of solipsism. It said every show pretended it was the only show on TV. It not only ignored every other show on TV, ignored all of the ambient culture around it. It was just about itself. And now TV is pulling in, as I say, pulling in culture from around it, culture being generated by TV and culture that's being generated by everything that's happening in our culture. And it pulls it in and it plays it back out again in the form of these arresting stories. And then that comes up into conversation on a Saturday night in a bar. And that's where you can really see where this, where the change has taken place. Remember in the old days, people go to a bar, they'd run into friends or strangers, and their lab would, you know, laboriously find their way through a conversation about one thing or another. Now the surest route to an engaging conversation is, what are you watching? Oh yeah, I love that show, or not. And then you start talking, but then these conversations get fabulously kind of nuanced and interesting as people compare responses to, and then they start breaking down the scene and they start questioning the casting decisions and they say, you know, I'm not comfortable with what they did there. Surely, you know, not X would have been the better strategy. So all of this is to say, the big headline that I'm trying to headline here very successfully is that American culture has become, has its own genuine, legitimate center on which to draw, and that's called television. And that changes, you know, changes who and what we are as a culture, and you know, what we have to hope for, or at least what I hope for, is that at some point the economics approach to marketplace behavior, the economics approach to buying and selling, will someday undergo a transformation of its own, where it goes from being this very partial view that is the enthusiasm of a few people in C-suites and academic economists, and the rest of us just go, really, you've really failed to grasp or to capture some of the things we care about most. Indeed, you've done this very kind of strange and a thing of actually ignoring your own interests. You're actually creating value here that you refuse to acknowledge. When you refuse to acknowledge it, you can't persuade anybody to pay for it, and you are violating your obligation to the shareholder. That's, of course, the great holy grail for many people in most organizations, is that you have to make sure you recover all the value you create in the world. And in this case, in the case of dark value, people aren't.
Well, I think that's actually one of the things I want to jump in and pose a question for you, because it precisely is that monetization piece. You know, traditionally, one of the things that people think about when they think about television programming was actually the program wasn't the product. The commercial was the product, and the program was the candy coating that delivered the commercial to your living room. And that was the economic, that's how it was paid for. Films were always different. Films were always the product in and of themselves. Then you have something like Netflix come along, and they make the program the product. They make the television program the product. And by removing commercials, you can have sustained narratives. You can have more complex narratives. You don't have to, you're not breaking up your storyline. You can have more complex characters because people are able to understand over a period of time. They're not forced to drop in and out. However, by removing that piece, you've just removed your revenue. So, you know, here you are, you've created the better product, you've disrupted the marketplace, but you've lost your revenue. So how do you fix it?
Right. I'm not sure they have to fix it. I think that's what the subscription fee is for. And effectively, instead of paying for a show by watching and by being forced to watch ads, we're paying for it by through our subscriptions, subscriber fee, which I think is, you know, generally seen to be the better deal.
Yeah, well, I think to push it a little, one of the things that I think is challenging when I think about dark value is, you know, we look at tech startups and they have huge multi-billion-dollar valuations. You know, Snapchat is what, $10 billion, but it generates very little revenue, let alone profit. And as a small business owner myself, this confuses me. I can't do that, you know. And I think, you know, isn't it the mandate to maximize profit? And Silicon Valley defies that. And so how does dark value fit into that? You know, how ultimately you do need to have money. And we could say, well, Netflix is a proxy for how you can harness your dark value. But what about some of the different players. You have traditional networks, cable providers who are in possession of great products. And they're maybe redefining how consumers use those products, but they're unable to monetize the products as fully or effectively as they'd like to. And so what are they to do?
Yeah. No, I think Silicon Valley, especially in the early days, was absolutely awash with dark value. And it was dominated, in that case, not so much by economists who didn't want to talk about dark value, but by engineers. And my favorite example here is actually Friendster. Remember, Friendster was hot in like not for about 10 months in 1995, I think it might have been. And it lasted a very brief period because it couldn't quite get a handle on what it was doing, what it was selling. And it wasn't until Facebook came along that, Facebook could have been the next Friendster. They weren't, I think, because they insisted on including photographs, and they made it possible for people to exchange images of themselves back and forth between themselves, to tag images of themselves. They made, in those early days, people thought, as LinkedIn sort of still does, that networking online was going to be kind of like a Rolodex. It was going to be, a good way of keeping track of who you were connected to and easier to keep track of how to get in touch with them when you wanted to.
Well, it's almost as if they're approaching it, in a very scientific way, rather than thinking about the impact these communities actually, people are not robots. They do not operate independently. They're organisms within a network of other organisms, and those organisms influence their choices. And
exactly. You could argue that Adam Smith, we could lay this at the door of Adam Smith, and I've had some quite bitter conversations about this issue. Some people want to say, he was kosher on this score. But let's call it the Adam Smith legacy. The notion was, let's slice away everything that's social and cultural and emotional and networked about economic behavior, and let's just pretend it's always about the pursuit, the maximizing of utility, the pursuit of advantage, defined in the most narrow possible way. And we're kind of still living with that heritage, even as we find ourselves in a world where the capitalism is kind of being deindustrialized by the artisanal revolution and the sharing revolution and the philanthropic projects of every kind.
Well, there's a great Evonomics, the next evolution of economics. There's a great article about the future of economics using the science of real life social networks. I actually just saw it today. And it's exactly that. And it's sort of, Adam Smith, in the throes of the Industrial Revolution, this is sort of the new religion of science and logic and, engineering, if you will. We're engineering our society, and life has changed. Life is different, or at least there's a recognition of that. I am curious, want to jump back a bit to programming. We have this wonderful raising the bar of programming. Fantastic. Then what explains the Kardashians? It's sort of mind-boggling. You have the largest TV deal in history, something like $100 million, 4-year contract. How do they fit in? We've raised the bar, and then we have this, or TLC's perpetual dysfunctional, train wreck of a family. Broken people on a TV show. How do we explain that?
Yeah, I don't know that I have an exhaustive or even a very good explanation, but some of this is, people like to say she's famous for being famous, and I think that's really wrong, and it really gives away the opportunity to figure out what's going on here, which, as nearly as I can tell, is that she is an exercise in the spectacular, and I mean that kind of literally, in that sense of things that are out of scale, and I think, you could say that she is the Donald Trump of the world of entertainment, that both of them seek to explode expectations and defy conventions and to do stuff that leaves you kind of agog. I mean, the numbers, the wardrobes, the husband, the weddings, the, you know, the stuff she's managed to put together is almost always looking for the spectacular. And so I think that's some of it.
Is there a link to economic contraction? I mean, you know, sort of like if you think about the Busby Berkeley spectaculars during, you know, the Depression, and that people can't have these things, and so they vicariously enjoy things.
Yeah, I think, you know, and this is me just really, this is a perilous thing to say because it's so potentially fatuous, though I do trade in the fatuous from time to time. She is, you know, you think about an America through the 19th and 20th century was a place that was limitless in its scale. And everything, time you turn around, it would be America was boundless. And, you know, things were happening that really did boggle the imagination. That it was, if by spectacular we mean something that really so exceeds our capacity to grasp what it is that we have this slightly kind of astounded feeling. You know, you can feel the eyes kind of rolling back in your head. You're so astonished by what you see. I think, you know, that America has gone away. And it's gone away in the big picture. And it's gone away in, I did a project for the Ford Foundation, and their question was, what happened in the middle of American politics? And part of the answer is that notion of, it's not spectacular here, it's not giant scale, but it's just that the comfortable conviction that the world is prosperous enough that you, that that you'll be taken care of, that that you're, you know, you're that you are protected from hardship.
Well, and Trump is sort of the what we've just seen this past week at the convention. You know,
what we're seeing at the convention is that spectacle will only take you so far, and at some point the world says, and what else do you have? And in his case, it turns out he doesn't really have anything else.
Right. Well, look at the man behind the curtain, or pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, I suppose I should say.
Exactly.
Right. So going back, pulling ourselves back again to television and traditional players and, you know, live TV, where we still have advertisements, is it possible to have these two things simultaneously? Can you still have the live TV, or is the dark value disruption going to be so disruptive that it destroys or erodes traditional live TV? Or are there ways that the traditional players can adjust?
Yeah, and I think they are adjusting, and I think there's still a huge body of viewers out there for whom a Law and Order episode is just fine, right? That's there. And in fact, I've talked to people who are watching Law and Order episodes over and over and over again. So that there's some people who find the new television. I don't know if you've, have you seen the new AMC show called Preacher? It's a beaut. I mean, it's absolutely completely. I mean, if you've seen the comic book from which it comes, I guess you kind of know what's happening, but I haven't. So the whole thing is a total surprise to me. And that's, I think, for an anthropological purpose, you know, when a cultural artifact is completely surprising, when you find yourself incapable and anticipating where it's going next, that's when you know you've moved from kind of prefab culture, kind of genre-based stuff, to something that's genuinely creative and original. I think, where was I going with this? Sorry, I just got caught up in images of the preacher.
We were talking about sort of more traditional television and if there was a place for it. But I guess shifting maybe, or maybe refining the question in a slightly different direction. Traditionally, television channels would brand themselves, and you know, this channel was the family channel or the boys will be boys channel or what have you. And do you believe that it's in our culture with these products that it's possible to still brand a channel or a network? Or is it only relevant at the show level? There's a term you use, cool hunting, and maybe right. First maybe talk about that in relation to, you know, everybody's, what they're trying to do.
Right. I mean, that cool hunting thing is an interesting question because it presupposed, and this was especially true in the 90s, and it was the thing that everybody was mad about in the 90s, and that was a model that said, you've got mainstream cultural producers at the center, then you've got more avant-garde kind of creatures on the margin, and that the stuff in the middle is completely not interesting, and the stuff in the margin is experimental and risk-taking, and the way the ecology works by the mainstream kind of stealing from the margin, letting it cool a little bit and playing it up. So, you know, Madonna stealing from the streets of New York City and turning it into a brand on MTV. So the case in point. So that's, I think, broken down now. And I think it's been a real stunner for us to see it go because it was kind of the true north or the, you know, it was the compass that organized how we saw the world and how we positioned ourselves relative to the world. Now we see real creativity happening at the center. And now we see the margin being sometimes outdone by the center, or at least it's no longer being preyed upon by the center. So that's when you know, American culture is a culture, plain and simple, no longer merely a popular culture, is when that happens. So the best way to put this is to say that cool hunting is dead. That notion that you have to go and find it somewhere else and steal it from someone else and then take it and make it a source of profit for yourself. If you want, that was a kind of dark value being stolen and made bright by ABC or NBC. That model is, it might still be going on for certain purposes for, you know, NBC is struggling to anyway.
No, I guess what I wanted to understand is it a function of the internet and the long tail and the ability of these people to get their own voices out there and found, you know, that we have all of these people pumping out content and there's a democratization of content creation. However, as the marketplace becomes flooded, while we can create, there's a democratization for creation, discovery becomes the next barrier because, and then the gatekeepers of curation, the gatekeepers there, you know, all of a sudden, if you can't be found, I mean, it's not a matter of if you make it, they will show up to watch it. They got to know it's there.
Totally. And this is reaching crisis proportions. And I think there are two parties that I think suffer particular injury. There's the fanfic producer or just the cultural creator who this summer is going to have to work at McDonald's because, damn it, there's no money in fanfic. There's no value being that individual may be creating extraordinarily good stuff from fanfic point of view. But as you say, there's no way of rewarding his or her efforts. The other piece here, is the curatorial role, right? I mean, we're getting a little bit of this, and I just came across a book I absolutely love because it kind of predates the whole debate. It's by Rich. Shoot, I'm blocking his first name. Anyhow, it's called San Francisco Noir. And it's this person who sat down with all of his favorite noir films that happened to show or to be set in some part of San Francisco. And it's put together this slender book that takes you through. It's an encyclopedia of all the films and what part of San Francisco they capture. And it's just a beautiful piece of curatorial activity that makes several films that you would never watch otherwise. Suddenly they're interesting because this guy has created this frame that makes all these pictures go together. So that curatorial role, there's no money in it, except for this guy. I hope to God he made some money from the book, and that's what we have to hope for. But these days, right, you could have that project not make any money. So now it seems to me, you know, Google and especially Google have made fantastic amounts of money seeing to the distribution of this material, of all the material that's online. But I think it's time for them to share the wealth with the fan players on the one hand and the curators who help us find that work on the other. And it's like, you know, this is just, you know, we have, as I say, we've got people working at McDonald's this summer who are fabulously talented and could spend that summer getting even more talented. Thank you very much. And so that's got to change. And I think there's some huge, you know, I was hoping that some part of the branded world would step up and say, we will be the champions of, and we will create the plumbing that we need to get fractional amounts of value from, you know, maybe it starts with a great gift from Google, and Google now gives us, each of us, as we're using the search engine, $20, and we leave tips when we find work we especially admire. And you know, that's probably not the right scale to do this, but you know, it would be fantastic for the person who's doing the fanfic. Enough tips would mean you don't work at McDonald's this summer. So I don't know how you would get the numbers right, but that feels to me just like an inevitable idea. And somebody who wants to be the next Jack Dorsey could claim that position in the larger scheme of things by creating a system of this kind that persuades those two groups.
Well, it would be interesting. I mean, I think you'd probably have a certain amount of people actively dissuading that. You know, you may have, look at Facebook, all of its value is the micro content that we all voluntarily hand over. And if we all said, gee whiz, Facebook, you are worth nothing without my piece of, pull our videos, we all pull our content, then you have no value. So, and LinkedIn.
Let's make that happen.
Yes, let's.
Seriously, we should do this. We should absolutely make this happen. And we should, and I don't know where this issue now stands, but we should say, listen, until you make good on this, I want my photos back. I want my content back. Not only is nothing forthcoming, but I want all the stuff that you have in those vaults.
Interesting, gripping stuff. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Gabriella. Thank you.
Well, we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few people who have been important to bringing the program to life. First and foremost, I want to thank Grant McCracken for a wonderful interview. Also, a big thank you to our past guests and new friends, Michael Brooks and Phil McKenzie, for introducing us to Grant. I also want to thank my friend Rob Naughton for his voice talent at the top and our production team from Microfame Media. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.